I thought for a while that I might be here as a personification of humility, but I think that that's not true either. Henry Steele Commager, addressing himself to the 50 years which have passed since the armistice, 1918, wrote an article published in the Saturday Review last November, and he, in the title of the article, asked the question, 1918 to 1968, is the world safer for anything? And he suggests that 1918 did not usher in the millennium. It rather ushered in a half century of conflict, turbulence, war, revolution, desolation, and ruin on a scale never seen before. It was a half century that leveled more cities, ravaged more countries, subverted more societies, obliterated more of the past, endangered more of the future, cost more lives, and uncovered more savagery than any time since the barbarians swarmed over Western Europe. Ancient nations were overthrown, empires fragmented, principles of law subverted, traditional standards of morality repudiated. The era which was to have seen the end of the war, ushered in instead the most terrible of wars. And it rose to a climactic conclusion in the most terrible of weapons, the era which was to have seen the triumph of democracy, ushered in the triumph of tyranny, the era which was to have witnessed the triumph of science over the inveterate ills, heard instead the hoofbeats of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Now I submit that if we substituted some of the terms in the paragraph above, we could very well describe some of the things that we've heard today, some of the things that ecologists have been calling to our attention. Crisis, impact of man, genetic implications of a polluted environment, technology, adaptation, aesthetics, education, laws, nature, industry, society, conservation, noise, indicate to us the web, the interlocking web, which is our environment. The seriousness of our situation is greater since we live in the illusion that the problem is a problem of the future. We are lured to complacency because we somehow have the idea that the problem will solve itself. Some of you have read recently the published book by the Russian physicist Andrei Sakharov titled Progress, Coexistence, and Intellectual Freedom, and he calls our attention to the same problems to which attention has been called today. He says that the problems of dumping detergents and radioactive wastes, the erosion and salinization of soils, the flooding of meadows, the cutting of forests on mountain slopes and on watersheds, the destruction of birds and the senseless despoilation caused by local, temporary, bureaucratic, and egotistical interest, and sometimes simply by questions of bureaucratic prestige, huge problems. And he calls attention to Lake Baikal in Russia, a lake which he describes as being 400 miles long and a mile deep, described as containing virtually one-fifth of the fresh water in freshwater lakes in the world. And the campaign to keep it from being polluted, but he says now there are pulp industry at the edge and they're pumping wastes into this marvelous lake. That's our problem. He is persuaded that the problem cannot be solved on a local or regional basis because it's so closely tied to economic and social problems. We sought to talk about that and to describe it today. Last Sunday, I saw, as many of you did, that picture of the Earth taken by the astronauts from the perspective of the moon. I suspect that what we've been trying to say here today is that that's the business. That's the whole ball of wax. Pollute it, and you've got a problem. That's the reason that we have had the symposium. That's the reason that we have our speaker who is with us tonight, Dr. Joseph Sittler, professor of theology at the Divinity School of the University of Chicago. Educated at Wittenberg College, Hammond Divinity School, graduate study in various places, professor of theology at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, and subsequently at the University of Chicago. Dr. Sittler is well known as a lecturer, preacher, and ethicist. He has been heard on literally dozens of our campuses across the country, but he tells me that this is the first occasion that he's had at being here at Augsburg College. We're delighted that he can be here tonight. He comes to the subject not newly. He is one of the people who has addressed himself to the care of the earth, to the ecological crisis, long before some of the others have thought of it. In 1961, Professor Sittler was a delegate to the World Council of Churches meeting in New Delhi, India. And Time magazine said this about this man: perhaps the most original and challenging address given at the assembly came from Lutheran Dr. Joseph Sittler, professor of theology at the University of Chicago Divinity School. Before he left for New Delhi, Sittler told a Chicago friend what he had in mind. Christians, he said, were too much inclined to dismiss communist ideology as barren materialism. But communism succeeds, said Dr. Sittler, because it is not materialism. All things are given value and purpose and drawn into a huge vision for the totality of man and the world. In contrast, he suggested, Christianity has shrunk until it's little more than a support for our weakness, companion to our loneliness, counselor to our neuroticisms, and heavenly confirmer of our national purpose. He's been aware of our problem, and he's going to address us tonight on this subject. I give you Professor Joseph Sittler.
Thank you, sir. Mr. President, members and friends of the college, I have indeed never been here before, but one of the reasons it's nice to be here is that I reflect in my memory to my first and greatest teacher in theology, and this was his college. In Springfield, Ohio, I was a student of Dr. John Olaf Evgen, under whom we had a series of 14 lectures on Sverdrup. I doubt if any other college outside this one ever enjoyed this sequence of elaborations of the work of George Sverdrup, but we did, whether we liked it or not. I looked over the program very carefully and tried to see what I might most usefully do, which would not be a repetition of things that have been done, nor be a kind of condensation of the repertorial and statistical facts which lie back of the very calling of this conference, because these facts constitute the problem. And it seemed to me that in looking at my placement on the program and the contrast between what I regularly do as a vocation and what those others do, that you wanted an effort to relate the facts and the concerns of this conference to the theological and ethical tradition of the Christian tradition. And therefore, from that starting place, I want now to address you, and I come into it in a kind of oblique way, because that's the way the issue presented itself in my own experience. It seems to me that the word ecology signifies a kind of intersection of many human concerns and many kinds of discipline and inquiry, but the word ecology is an intersection word, and ecology today, as I reflect on several conferences on the subject I've attended, ecology is an enormously rich and fruitful thing looking for an adequate conceptualization. All the elements that enter into the ecological comprehension of the interrelatedness which constitutes life is vivid, is a picture of enormous and pressing peril, as well as mad promise for human fulfillment, but it is a fragmented kind of a discipline. And it's a discipline looking for a vision having the scope of its vitality, or a conceptualization which will have the adequacy to the many components that enter into the making of ecological reflection. And the thesis of what I want to talk with you about tonight is to make the proposal that in the Judeo-Christian understanding of man, the fellow man, the earth, you have the possibility of such a conceptualization. A conceptualization which must precede the envisionment of the ethicality that must match it. And because the problem is therefore a difficult problem of intellectual conceptualization and requires a reinterpretation of many elements of the Christian tradition, the problem is too important for a popular speech. And therefore, promising not to be too lengthy, I want to ask you to share with me a very condensed piece of reflection in the hope that I can do justice to the size of an egg you've laid before me. Now, I want to begin by saying how my own reflections on this matter were engendered, in fact, excited. Some years ago, I was appointed to the Chicago Mayor's Committee on Lake Michigan. He really is a man who cares about Lake Michigan. That needs a bit of establishment, but I won't go into that, but he really does. And about 9 years ago, he appointed a citizens committee, and someone who knew my theological peculiarities suggested that he ought to have one churchman on there, and I was the one. So I've served on that committee now for 9 years. Long before the actual situation in Lake Michigan became a matter newsworthy, as they say, and to make the front page, many of us suspected what was going on and were concerned for the future of that lovely lake. Now, that is one element, and that intersected another one. At the same time, I began to be active on that committee and asked what my role was as a churchman and a member of a civic committee. My own reflections upon the doctrine of grace in the Christian tradition were by other factors excited into a new study of the New Testament and our Christian tradition, particularly our Lutheran theological tradition on that matter, and Lake Michigan and my reflections on doctrine of grace, as it were, flowed together. And out of that, I began to see things theologically, aquatically, ecologically, in quite a new way. And I want tonight to really recapitulate how I came to understand things so that I am now able to propose, and not to defend against all comers, but to propose for our common reflection a Christian conceptualization of a possible way of regarding the world, a Christianly born way of renovating the spirit of our minds on this matter, as St. Paul urged us to do. I begin where the speaker, I understand, this morning began, with the book of Genesis. I would first like to suggest that biblical philology would suggest that dominion is not domination, that dominion, rather than annihilating the understanding of care, is a Hebrew way of underlining exactly that. Because in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis, a fundamental proclamation of the first chapter of Genesis is the proclamation that man is a triply constituted thing, that he is triply related to God from whom he comes by the relationship of the fellow man, the other, with whom he lives, and to the earth, which is the garden of his ancient habitation. And these three primal relationships are constitutive of humanity. He is triply related. The book of Genesis unfolds in all of its chapters to make clear how the primal fault is not a slippage or error in any one of these, but simultaneously, as it were, in all of these. That the defect in the one is infectious and picked up by defects in the other two. Now, understanding Genesis in this way, one is able to see why that literary corpus, the Old Testament, which is the confession, the record, the prayer, the history, peculiar kind of history, but history of Israel, why in the Old Testament the doctrine of the grace of God has a scope which is identical with the scope of the creation. The word hen in the Old Testament is probably the best equivalent for the New Testament charis. But hen, which means the mercy, the grace, the effective goodness in benevolent action from God, who in himself is not knowable. The hen, or grace of God, is not a New Testament creation. The New Testament in one gospel begins by saying, grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. It never suggests that grace was invented by Jesus Christ. Grace in the Old Testament is a word whose theater is centered in God's historical care for his elect. But the scope of grace in the Old Testament is identical with the whole creation. And that is why the lyrical expressions of the faith of Israel in the Old Testament, particularly in some of the Psalms and in three of the prophets, the lyrical exposition of Israel's faith always uses language about man's joy in God in quite material, earthy, ecological terms. The wine that maketh glad the heart of man, the cattle on a thousand hills, the conies, the birds, the animals, the fecundity of the earth, the seasons that come and go, the periodicities that mark man's life in his relation to the world out there, and which are registered with a kind of pathos of passingness in the interior world within, all of these ecological relationships between man's relationship to the world, which is God's creation and the theater of his grace, these are always related to God's particular care for Israel, which is, as it were, a focal point and the burden of his grace upon a peculiar people. Now, when we come to the New Testament, one finds that the term the grace of God is completely continuous with the grace known and articulated by the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And this grace is affirmed to have come in an incandescent, incarnate, and personalized agency whose name is identical with Israel's whole history, whose role is to disclose in judgment and in mercy the meaning of Israel's ancient transactions with the God of grace, as it were, a new inning in the dealings of God with his people. So that the word the grace of God in the New Testament is not discontinuous with its ancient understanding, but, and here's where the plot begins to thicken, the interpretation of the meaning of grace and the scope of grace, or the orbit of grace, has not been in post-New Testament times completely faithful to the riches of the New Testament on this point. And here's where I must ask you to be patient while I go into what normally would be called pedantry, but after all, you are not men on the street. It is the function of this college for 100 years to call people in off the street for exactly this kind of reflection, so I plunge into it. The word grace in the New Testament and the word Christ, the love of God and the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ in the doxological statement, these occur together in the great summary epistles of Paul with extraordinary regularity, so that grace and Christ are Christianly equivalents, as it were, things that cannot be unfolded in their meaning without the illumination of the other. And therefore, the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ in the New Testament has been differently interpreted by the two great traditions of East and West. And I hope before I completely break down or crack up of senility to get a book done on this subject, but I've worked on it and want to tell you what I think I'm sure I see here. Now, it is not without possibility of criticism, and I do it with a certain hesitancy, with Edgar Carlson sitting around here, who has for a long time been one of my most acute critics, but okay, we'll do it. It seems to me very clear that Western Christianity, particularly Western Christology, has understood the meaning of the grace of God in the Lord Jesus Christ in a way which almost disqualifies that Christology from confronting the problems that you have explicated in these 2 days. A typically Western Christology has got to turn itself in a quite unusual direction and twist itself free from centuries of solidification around certain concepts in order to be freed to have a Christology for ecology. And my proposal is that there is another way of reading the New Testament and another strand in the unfolding of Christology which has more amply understood this and which must now be called both to enhance and to correct and maybe to some degree displace a quite Western Christology. Western Christology, to characterize it first, and the almost heroic oversimplification of these theological and historical matters I must apologize for. I really know better, but I've only got an hour. That Christology, let us look at it as Augustine really fashioned it, gave it a schematic and symphonic conceptualization which dominated 1,000 years, with which Luther was continuous so that he could call him Father Augustine rightly. How did Augustine and, on the whole, the Roman Christian West understand the grace of God? Primarily as that action whereby the grace of God restores man to God by the forgiveness of his sin. Grace and sin are developed in Western theology and Christology in such close connection that each word evokes the other like an almost automatic B.F. Skinner response. When you hear sin, you think of grace. When you hear grace, oh, that's what's done about sin. Well, that is not wrong. That is indeed the central core of the whole development. But a thing can be so acknowledged to be central with such power that it fills the whole space of a very rich concept, leaving no room for resonances which do not naturally belong there. And it seemed to me that's what's happened in Western Christology. Tertullian, for instance, accomplished, to quote Seberg, an acute moralization of Christology for the whole future of Western theological developments. And then Augustine, those of you who have had theological training recall, Augustine said, the way grace impacts upon nature is as follows. It is gratia preveniens, that is, it comes before us. It was before we were sinners. It is. It does not depend upon your acknowledgement, your recognition, or your joy, or your rejection. Baptism is a kind of enormous symbolization of prevenience of grace. Grace is gratia preveniens. It is gratia operans. It works. It is not just a benevolent dream of a distant God. It is an historical agency, action, and force. It is gratia operans which engenders gratia cooperans. It works upon me to make my work, by virtue of its work, a new kind of God relationship. And it is gratia subsequens. It has a career. It changes the attitude and stance of man, not only before God, but before his fellow men. Now this rigid, clear, and in many ways centrally true understanding of grace has completely dominated Western theological reflection about the meaning, the force, the scope, and the places of grace's availability. When we say grace is available in the hearing of the gospel and in the participation in the sacraments, these are the means of grace. We do not tell a lie, but we do not tell enough truth. The means of grace are not so reduced, it seems to me, in a right reading of the opulence of the New Testament speech about grace. Now, that is why this Western Christological development, that is why it developed an iconography of the agent of grace, which is Christ on the cross. Christ crucified, the image and the agency of the atoning work. Christ as doing the deed, which is the action of God whereby man is restored to him. This has become the primary icon of the meaning of Christ in Western Christendom from the second century until now. Now, is there another way of going at this? Back of this Western Christology lies a reading of Paul, an interpretation of Paul, a focusing selectively around what perhaps that time in the church's unfolding was much needed by the church in the disintegrating empire. But, as a matter of fact, there is another way, because there are other ways of reading the New Testament. From the Old Testament background in which grace, the theater or the field of grace, is not only focused in God the Redeemer, but active in the world of God the Creator, there are passages in the New Testament which speak of Christ in terms which can only be described in as a swirling orbit. The referential largeness of the Christological reference begins with Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and then the language goes out and out and out. He is that principle by which all things are made. He is that in whom all things hold together. He is the life of all things and the light that shines upon all things, whereby they are beheld by man. Augustine talks about Christ is not only the light that illuminates things, He is the light within the beholding eye, whereby in God I behold the truth of things that are illumined. So the language in Colossians, in which he is the principle, the logos, the interior contiguity of things, the glue whereby all things constitute a creative unity and move toward a common gracious destiny. This is all suggested in the Colossians, in the first chapter of Ephesians, and again in the third, and in the letter to the Romans. There is the amazing and tough passage, which I recall in 13 years as a pastor, I always ducked that pericope when it came around and chose the gospel lesson instead, because I really did not understand it, and I do not claim to understand it now, but neither can I shake myself loose from the allure of that tremendous passage about the whole creation that groans in travel, standing, as it were, expectantly waiting for something which is suggested as being only capable of being realized when man's relationship to nature undergoes a real conversion. When man relates himself to nature differently, there is that in the natural world which hitherto unfolded has folded blessings waiting to unfold for itself and for man. Now that's no eisegesis. This is what the man really says. What all this means goes all the way from speculations which try to get rid of that passage as being a Gnostic-inspired aside on the part of the Apostle Paul, to the great work of Théo de Chardin, who looks at it as a kind of evangelical basis for an enormous speculative job in his book, The Future of Man. Anyhow, this strand in New Testament speech about Christ and man and the world and the world process, this kind of speech, moralized in the West, was ontologized and made cosmic in the East. I want to throw some light upon that problematic statement by an illustration. The moment you walk into an Eastern Orthodox church, whether it be a primitive church or a contemporary church, whether it be Russian, Bulgarian, Hungarian, Greek, Syrian, whatnot, the fundamental form of the church is itself an evocative icon. The Christ who greets you in the Orthodox Church is, as a central figure, never, never the immolated Jesus on the cross, who underwent death in order to deal with man's cruciality by virtue of a crucifixion and a death. The figure of Christ who meets you in an Orthodox church is the Christus Rex, or in Greek church, in the Greek liturgy, the Pantokrator, the alive Christ, always iconographically illustrated in a poor church by a painting, in a very rich one in mosaic, always as the Christ alive, significantly in the curved dome of the church, which is a symbol of the whole world under the rulership of God as Christ the world principle and world ruler. So that there is a Christology in the Eastern Church which swims in an orbit which does not ignore the moral situation of man before God, does not ignore the cruciality of God's action for that situation, but that is the axis of their worship and not the outermost dimension of it. One has only to read the liturgies of the Eastern Church to see that Christology is the axis around which this worship spins, but the whole cosmos is the habitation of the grace of God. all the operations that men undertake in that cosmos have ultimate woe or weal, according to whether or not they are illuminated by dealing with the given creation as a realm of grace. Now, this is saying to us, it seems to me, that there is possible within the richness of the Christian tradition, which tradition is now breaking out of its provincialism, its historical entrapments, its ethnical provincial entrapments, which often have the nature of a kind of pride. Because Christendom is breaking out of its separated traditions, and the Western Christology is being ever more deeply penetrated by and urged to go back and recover the riches of another way in Christology, one has some basis for his hope that our generation may develop a Christology which has the strengths of both, but the largeness, the recovered largeness of the East. And if I may put a footnote in here for those who particularly want to follow this matter out further. One of the men who, in his investigations of this matter, turned my nose in the direction of the foremost Eastern representative of this way of thinking was Gustav Wingren, in his Man and the Incarnation, I think is the name of the book, in his long chapter on Irenaeus. He has page after page of simply astounding statements from Irenaeus. Between Irenaeus and this Lake Michigan polluted moment, there is no other theologian who is so relevant. The way he talks of the earth, the way he talks of the earth itself as a secondary means of grace, man's relation to the earth and his interior sense of kinship with it. In the Bible, the earth is never called my mother, but she is called my sister. She is God's other creation who stands alongside me. So there is a sibling relationship between man as God's creation and the earth as his creation. And Paul's passage more than suggests that sibling relationship in creation is an ethical responsibility in the realm of redemption also. So that in Irenaeus you have a way of talking about how man beholds grace, the largeness of the phenomena in the midst of which he suspicions grace, the largeness of the operational sphere in which he is active as a child of grace, a series of passages which have a kind of relevancy that I find no place in Calvin or Luther or Thomas or the fathers whose work I happen to know with some care. Now, I want to make another angle for a moment. It seems to me that the elaboration of that technization of cognition, technization of operations in the world, which is so powerful a factor of our time, this very way of life, filling, as it were, all available space with its aggressive proposals for the living of life, is beginning to evoke protesting symbols from our generation. There are symbols of all kinds becoming more and more clear that what Diltai called the thingification of man is not a possible proposal. That there is something about the ductility of the human that will not be mathematized in this way, that knows itself to be itself despoiled, denuded, eviscerated by the very victory of that kind of understanding of how to deal with and live in the world. And these signals are becoming ever more strong. I want to point to some that I think are important. Why is it? And Susan Sontag's book on this subject doesn't throw a lot of light on the matter. Why is it that modern art has the character it has? Now, there are all kinds of historical developments that show that it did come from here to here to here to here and so forth, but historical report of how you got from A to X are not a sufficient causality. Modern art is characterized by a plain affection for the thingliness of things, the plain, uncluttered look, feel, texture, shape, fluidity, or solidity of things. Modern art is characterized by what Gilbert Chesterton once called an affection for the sheer steeliness of steel and the unutterable muddiness of mud. When you ask an artist why he does or puts certain things together, you do not get from him a deep principle of togetherness. What you get is they're interesting that way. Each, by putting two things together that seem unlike and inappropriate, they call attention to the individual, the immaculate particularity of each one, by not being related. And the crazy relationship enhances the exquisite nature of each. Now, this is what's happening. Why do you have sculptors that look like an I-beams on end that some construction job forgot? Or why do you have people rejoicing in just the plain gross isness of things without any decorative or cosmetizing effect? It's a new sensitivity. It's a new sensitivity that there is that in a thing permitted to be itself, which evokes from humanity a smile of recognition. And this is the smile that I would suggest is a kind of theological acknowledgement that we, after all, are fellow creatures. Now, let me illustrate that further. Some years ago, I was asked to sit on a consulting committee when Mies van der Rohe was doing the chapel for the Illinois Institute of Technology. Now, to build a chapel would not be one of the things he himself would think about or particularly approve. He just acquiesced in it. He designed the whole thing, and if they got money for a chapel, he designed that too. And you know Mies van der Rohe's work. He would rather die than build anything but a flat roof, and things are in rectangular shapes put in carefully nuanced relation to one another, and they're fascinating buildings, for certain purposes, I think, very reasonable buildings, and people who work in them say they work very well. Well, anyhow, I was on this committee, and somebody gave the IIT board enough money to build a chapel. I'm sure it was given. They never would put it in a budget. And he was told to design it. And he did, and when he brought the designs in for the details, the chapel's to be used by any group that wants, and it has a conventional altar and an altar rail, a free altar and an altar rail, and he had designed this altar rail out of stainless steel. Now, that was 15 years ago. That's before this kind of monkey business became quite common. And the stainless steel altar rail was a shocking thing. Everybody knows that you get altar rails made out of polished walnut from Grand Rapids, Michigan, period. That's what an altar rail is. It's always been that way. It really hasn't, but we thought so. So when he proposed this, the rationale that he had was the formula for stainless steel was brought to its refinement and out of experiments that began at Illinois Institute of Technology. Therefore, there's a kind of interior appropriateness in it being there. And he said, As a matter of fact, when they talk about a wooden altar, he says, isn't stainless steel made out of the same earth as a walnut altar rail? Or a wooden one? As a matter of fact, isn't stainless steel closer to these students as an evocation of the beauty and the possibility and the malleability of the common stuff of life? Isn't it closer to an Illinois Institute of Technology to have it out of steel than out of walnuts? How many walnuts have you seen lately? Just like my kids, they think Bordens make milk, you know. So he made his point, and there it is. And now, of course, it's old hat. But what he was pointing out was, again, from another angle, a lay angle, my point. The fact that the creation with which we deal is an enormously attenuated one, removed from the immediacies of our father's language about the creation by intervening technological and merchandising and packaging and refining steps, is really calls upon us not to make a fundamental change in theology, but to make a fundamental leap in reflection. I'm saying that the cattle on a thousand hills is not an evocative phrase in Chicago. That praise God from whom all hamburgers flow would be, of course, much closer to my children's experience, who have to take a ride in the country or go to the stock show to see a cow. Now, this means that this is leading up to the principle that man is shaped in his listening compass, his language forming possibility. He is given a range of intelligibilities largely in virtue of his operations that constitute his life. The scope of grace, the place of grace, has somehow got to be declared as there, within the field of our operations as modern men. Or it will be an ever more formal, contentless, and hopeful, pitiably hopeful phrase. Unless we can somehow domesticate the occasions of grace within the living of life, in the terms in which life presents that task to us in its unfolding in the modern age. Unless the occasions, the scope, the reality, the presence of grace can be put there, we have small chance to find a way of regarding the whole world as a task of grace, you see. And nothing less than this is what the unfolding of ecology calls for. When I said at the beginning that ecology is a rich and complex discipline awaiting for a comprehensive conceptualization which shall be as big as the threats and the perils it exposes, I meant to say that unless we behold the world as a place of grace, we will certainly deal with it as an agency of damnation and corruption. Unless it is seen as a vocation for use in grace, then we shall abuse and not properly use the world. Now that brings me to the end, where I should like to come to a couple of statements of this by a man who lived before the ecological data were as pressing as they now are. And so far as I know, he was not aware of this problem as a community or national problem. Gerard Manley Hopkins died in the last decade of the 19th century. As a poet, he was declared by Stephen Spender in these words, that is, his death was declared in these words, Hopkins ferments in every modern poet. Hopkins ferments in every modern man. Now, I want to say particularly to the students who are close up to this kind of thing in modern literature, if you don't know Hopkins, get with it. You can buy them for $1.25 in the Penguin Poets. Mine's a better one than that because I work it harder, but that's the one to get. Hopkins was a Jesuit. He was also a classicist. He was such a close observer of nature that the little pen drawings that he put into his notes while he was walking and gawking around have now been issued by the Oxford University Press, not because they're Hopkins, but because they're artistically that good. He was a remarkable man and in a sense, the creator of that peculiar angularity of modern poetry and that peculiar use of non-appropriate words alone to stretch the mind to do an appropriate thing, which characterizes modern poetry. I want to read you two of his poems in which it seems to me there is a way of standing within the world, viewing it out of a profound, devout Christology, which is alone adequate for the church's way to deal as her task with the ecological crisis. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of color coupled in a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire-coal chestnut falls finches' wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow, and plow, and all trades their gear and tackle and trim. All things counter, original, spare, strange. Whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how, with swift, slow, sweet, sour, adazzle, dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. And the other one is on with which I should close. Spring. Nothing is so beautiful as spring, when weeds and wheels shoot long and lovely and lush. Thrush's eggs look little low heavens, and thrush through the echoing timber does so rinse and ring the ear, it strikes like lightnings to hear him sing. The glassy pear tree leaves and blooms, they brush the descending blue, that blue is all in a rush with richness. The racing lambs, too, have fair their fling. What is all this juice and all this joy? A strain of earth's sweet being in the beginning in Eden Garden. Have get before it cloy, before it cloud, Christ, Lord, and sour with sinning. Innocent mind and mayday in girl and boy, most, O man's child, thy choice, and worthy the winning. Thank you very much for the invitation to share this occasion.
Thank you, Dr. Sittler. I think that this entire symposium has been bracketed by some thinking and reflection in depth. Dr. Sittler asked me if there had been a plethora of data indicating the problem, whether or not we had been deluged with statistics. I'm sure that these have come out in various instances in the smaller sessions, but this morning and this evening we have been down at bedrock in trying to understand those basic principles which will undergird any human attempt to deal responsibly with this world. And so I guess we will have to confess that all of it has had a kind of theological or religious or spiritual ring. And maybe we, in all of this discussion of our prayers and parables and evangelical ecology, had better take seriously the simple words of one of the orders, ora et labora. And we ought to be about our work with a new spirit and with a new viewpoint, because a great deal, of course, remains to be done to really come to grips with this issue of fashioning a quality environment. I guess they've told enough stories today, but I'm going to close with one that many of you have heard me tell before, about the man who came late to church one Sunday, and he sat down in the back pew, and the congregation was singing a hymn. He couldn't determine whether the hymn was the one before or after the sermon. So he turned to a little boy and he said, "Is the sermon done yet?" And the little boy said, "It's been preached, but it ain't been done." And I guess that's just about where this leaves us as we bring this symposium to a close, with a word of thanks to Mr. Don Imsland, who has been a great help to us in putting this together, and all of those on the committees, and all of those who have had a part in making this day a success. We thank you for coming, and good night.